This is the North Sound Energy Week podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Energy Week podcast. I'm Fiona Winchester. A week which saw thousands of jobs predicted for the North Sea oil and gas industry, anger over changes to feed-in tariffs for solar power, a long-running legal battle over holidays for offshore workers draw to a close, and climate change targets put under the microscope. On Monday, a new report predicted thousands of jobs for the northeast oil and gas industry. 100 decision makers in the sector were questioned for the Lloyds Banking Group Oil and Gas Rising Fortunes Market Report. It claims more work for the supply chain will see 75% of companies create new posts in the next 2 years. Pat Riley from the bank filled us in on the details.
We've recently conducted a piece of research which has some very positive findings for the oil and gas industry. It's talking about growth in industry being expected to lead to thousands of new jobs, leading to more orders for the supply chain, and that means more revenue for the supply chain. 75% of the oil and gas companies expect to create new jobs over the next 2 years. More than one in four, that's 28% of oil and gas businesses, expect to recruit over 500 people. 87% of senior decision makers within the sector say that they're on track for growth in the next 2 years. And 83% expect to increase orders through the supply chain next year as the ripples are felt through the industry. So all in all here, very, very positive news for the industry, for the people working in the industry. And I would suggest also, given the fact that a lot of the people who work in the industry are based in the northeast of Scotland, it will be good for our local economy as well. It's very, very good news for the sector and for the people working in the sector, and also the spin-offs that's going to come through our local economy. It's not the only sector out there, but it's certainly one that I would suggest that anyone who is looking for a job should seriously think about. There should be plenty of opportunities going forward. We understand the oil and gas industry and are supporting corporate business in Scotland right through the supply chain. This is not only through much-needed lending, but also through the provision of high-level expertise and ongoing business advice. In 2011, Lloyds Bank Corporate Markets provided more funding to the oil and gas sector than any other. This included high-profile transactions such as Wood Group's $1 billion acquisition of PSN and, more recently, Global Energy's purchase of the Nigyard. It's extremely positive for this particular sector compared to a number of other sectors, much more tougher, I would suggest, in a number of other sectors. So really good news for the oil and gas industry.
On Tuesday, Energy Minister Fergus Ewing met with solar panel companies across the country who are being affected by UK government changes to feed-in tariffs. The coalition government have decided to halve the amount of money owners of solar panels receive for supplying electricity to the grid, from 43.3 pence per kilowatt hour to 21 pence. The proposed changes will be implemented next week, just 6 weeks after they were first announced and a week before the UK consultation officially closes. Solar panels installed before the deadline will receive the old tariff for 25 years, but those installed just one day afterwards will see their tariff halved in April. Labour MSP for the Highlands and Islands, David Stewart, is outraged at the plans.
Well, I think the feed-in tariffs are a very innovative way of approaching renewable energy. It really allows domestic customers to be able to fit solar panels and really have a 25-year guarantee of a certain rate of return. Unfortunately, the UK government has slashed that rate of return, and they're currently reviewing, but it's about half of what it was previously. Now, that's got a number of impacts. First of all, it's obviously going to dramatically reduce the amount of customers who approach installers to have solar panels. Secondly, it's going to have a huge economic impact because firms that utilise that technology will be laying people off and have a downturn in their economic opportunities. And the third key thing, of course, is that we want to encourage the development of solar panels because that A helps towards our climate change targets and also our targets for 100% renewable production by 2020, or rather the Scottish Government's targets. So these are all a number of interlinked, quite vital pieces of information. There's no doubt they'll be put off. So, I mean, for many ordinary consumers, that will double your payback period, which won't be viable for many people. But what I'm arguing is that there is a solution to this. I've written today to Fergus Ewing, the Energy Minister, and I've argued that he uses a new budget that's now been made available from the fossil fuel levy, and that's around £110 million just for renewables in Scotland. And I've argued that what we should be doing is having effectively a Scottish top-up scheme, which would allow the scheme to run for at least another year at a much higher rate, around 43. Now, there's a number of advantages of that. That effectively will keep in employment all the companies across Scotland who are fitting solar panels. These are vitally important industry. They're effectively construction workers. And we need, at this time of high unemployment and growing worries about the economy, I think it's vital that we keep these key skills there. And secondly, it will encourage consumers to continue to use and fit solar panels because the rate's a lot more attractive. And of course, it helps towards our climate change targets as well. So I see this as a win-win. And the budget that's there is just for Scottish renewables. It can't be used for anything else. So I've written to Fergus Ewing, and I'm very hopeful that we'll see the benefits of this idea, and it really will continue to give a kickstart to our economy in the Highlands and Islands.
On Wednesday, one of the longest-running legal battles in the history of the oil and gas industry drew to a close. The Supreme Court in London threw out a claim from offshore workers that they should be entitled to paid holidays outside their field breaks. The norm is to work for 2 weeks on the rigs and then have a two-week break. But unions have spent years fighting to get 4 weeks paid holiday on top of that under European rules. But in the ruling this week, Lord Hope deemed under law they have enough time off already.
Refuses the request for a reference to the Court of Justice of the European Union, dismisses the appeal and affirms the interlocutor of the extra division of the Court of Session. A period of leave is not included within a period which is working time, as defined in the directive. It must be taken to be what the directive defines as a rest period, which is any period which is not working time. Annual leave is an annual period of rest. The directive does not imply any qualitative requirement to test whether a given period can be accounted as rest. The exercise that must be carried out is simply one of counting up the relevant hours, days, or seven-day periods and ensuring that the worker is not required to work during those periods. There is no indication anywhere that the directive was concerned about the quality of the minimum periods of rest other than to make it clear in the definition of rest period that it means a period which is not working time. The appellant's contracts were for the whole of the year, within which they were required to work for 26 weeks. The Court of Justice has not said that a preordained rest period when the worker is free from all obligations to the employer can never constitute annual leave. On the contrary, the term rest period simply means any period which is not working time. And any period includes or means every such period, irrespective of where the worker is at that time and what he is doing, so long as it is a period when he's not working. It is plain that any period when the appellants are on field break offshore onshore will fall into that category. The respondents are therefore entitled to insist that the appellants must take their paid annual leave during periods other than the 26 working weeks when they are onshore on field break. The court will now adjourn.
This is the North Sound Energy Week podcast.
Jake Molloy from the RMT Union has been leading the fight. Speaking with our reporter Emma Glacken after the ruling, Jake said his members will now consider industrial action.
Well, your listeners will be interested to understand what it means, because if they work shift patterns of any kind, what it means to them is that your employer could potentially now tell you to take your paid holidays during periods that you wouldn't normally work. In other words, if you work a 4 days on, 4 days off shift pattern, an employer can now tell you to take your paid leave during that period that you'd normally be off. That's what it means. For offshore workers specifically, it means no reduction in annual hours, and they have to take any holiday entitlement during the periods they would normally be off. Quite an appalling decision.
So no holidays over and above what they've already been allocated, really, as their time at home?
That's it. No holiday at all. No reduction in hours. But I think you've got to put the holiday aspect into context, because offshore workers work on the basis of equivalence. Because of the geographical nature of it, logistical problems, helicopter flights, etc., the shift patterns are put in place, but they still work 42 hours per week for 52 weeks of the year. That's the equivalent that they're working. There's nobody else in the country works 42 hours for 52 weeks of the year. Nobody. And that's why we're so angry that UK law has let these workers down. Had this been referred to Europe, we are supremely confident that the European courts would have ruled in our favour and would have applied a directive as it was meant to be applied and reduced annual hours. You don't spend 7 years drafting legislation for it to have no effect. It's just simply stupid.
So how would you sort of sum up today's ruling? I mean, mindless, or what do you think? Has it just been an oversight, do you think?
It's difficult to say without offending judges, and I've been told I'm not allowed to offend the judges. All I would say is we're living in a climate today which is geared for deregulation and revoking employment law. Whether or not the judgment today is a reflection of that, I would leave that to your listeners to decide, but it certainly appears that way to me, and it's got nothing, absolutely nothing to do with health and safety. And that's the other aspect of this. In an industry which claims health and safety is a priority, to fight against a directive which improves occupational health is a criminal act. They should be hanging their heads in shame today, the employers.
You've spoke about taking the case to Europe. Do you think, is that an option?
We can't take the case to Europe. That's it. The legal battle is finished. The only way we could get to Europe is with a referral from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's opted not to refer it to Europe, so we don't get to go to Europe. Despite the fact we have European commissioners telling us in black and white that paid leave should come from a period that you would otherwise work. We have it from a series of commissioners dating back years, which is why we're so angry again with the UK legal system. But as I say, for an industry that claims health and safety is priority, to fight against a directive which can only improve occupational health is quite appalling. They may be popping their champagne corks up in the ivory tower at Oil and Gas UK this morning, but I don't think they'll be popping corks for long, because the fight will continue, albeit by other means probably.
Just finally, Jake, any other final comments or anything at all to workers who've obviously been affected by this decision as well today?
Well, I would say to our members and also workers generally that we've tried the diplomatic route. It's failed. The UK legal system has, as ever, let the average working man down. And it appears to me, at least, there's only one means in which to achieve our goals. And we'll be calling our workers to rallies up and down the country in the early new year to discuss strategy and how we achieve our goals, because we will achieve our goals. We will win this fight. By hook or by crook, we'll win this fight.
North Sound Energy Week.
Donald McKinnon from Law at Work gave us his reaction to the ruling. He says a victory for the employees would have opened a whole new can of worms in other sectors.
I mean, obviously, it's a long-running dispute in the offshore industry, and it really revolves around employees' entitlement to their 5.6 weeks annual leave. And in the offshore industry, with the 26 weeks on, 26 weeks off pattern, the question was whether or not employees could be required to take their holidays at the period when they were onshore, or the employees were arguing that it doesn't make any sense to take holidays when you're not at work anyway. They should have their annual leave during a period that they're supposed to be offshore. And the Supreme Court in this particular case, it's gone all the way to the Supreme Court, has come down quite firmly in favour of the employers. From the employer's perspective, I think they will view it as a victory for common sense. It would have cost a considerable amount of money had the court found the other way. And I think other employers in other sectors have been watching this case with some interest because of the impact it could have in their field.
Certainly the union for offshore workers say, you know, that the fight is not over. They are interested in taking industrial action. How far could this go with industrial action? Would there be any point in it right now?
certainly from a legal perspective, the case is over. The employees had sought leave to take the matter to Europe, and the Supreme Court wouldn't allow them. So from a legal perspective, that's the claim at an end. As regards the further steps that employees might want to take, that clearly will be something for the union to talk to their members about. But I suspect that to a certain extent things have moved on, and I know that certainly when this case was raised, the pattern of work was 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. And my understanding is that the offshore industry has moved to a pattern now of 2 weeks offshore with 3 weeks onshore. So I'm not quite sure that there'll be the same depth of feeling on the matter given subsequent events. But you know, clearly, if the union wishes to take it further, then it would strike me that industrial action is probably the only option left open to them. The avenue of the courts has been closed off.
What I'm wondering is, with now legal action basically, you know, being over. I mean, obviously the case wasn't referred to by the Supreme Court to the European Court, so the avenue of legal action is over. Is there any point in them taking industrial action? What can they get through that?
Like I said, it will very much depend upon, you know. I know clearly the union is very disappointed at the outcome today, albeit it is the outcome that all the appeal courts have found. And I suspect it will come down to the depth of feeling within the offshore industry as to whether or not the people who are working out there feel that this is an issue, feel strongly enough about this issue that they wish to take industrial action. And I suppose from one point of view, people might look at the offshore industry and might feel that a pattern of, you know, 26 weeks offshore and 26 weeks onshore, why would they, you know, why would they have another 5.5 weeks on top of the period that they already have offshore? So there might be an issue in relation to what level of support there might be out there for such an action. But that, as I said, would be something that clearly the union would have to think about, and the members would have to think about before embarking on such a course.
I mean, just finally, Donald, do you think that this opens up the court now for other workplaces to impose these kind of holiday rules?
I mean, that's interesting, and it's certainly something that the Supreme Court was conscious of, is whether or not employers in other sectors could try and construct their working patterns so as to make employees, for instance, take annual leave at weekends when they wouldn't normally be working. And it certainly was the view of the Supreme Court, I think, that the fundamental principle of the working time regulations is people should have a proper rest break. There should be 5 weeks. And generally it should be in blocks of a week where people don't have to attend work and get the rest. And I think certainly in other... The offshore industry is to some extent unique, and the patterns are unique. And I suspect that any attempts by employers to construct the employment relationship so as to deprive people of holidays would be struck down. I suspect the significance of this case actually would have arisen had the court found for the employees, because that then would have opened up a can of worms, because of course there are many other types of sector, teachers for instance, who have to take their holidays at periods when the schools are shut, professional footballers who have to take their holidays in the off-season for instance, or even MSPs who take it during the parliamentary recess. All of these individuals could then argue, no, we should be taking our annual leave at periods that we're actually at work. And again, I think that was in the mind of the Supreme Court when they were looking at the general principles of this case. So I suspect it will not alter the relationship for the vast majority of employers and employees. And employees are still entitled to expect that there will be significant blocks of time when they don't have to attend work and they continue to get paid for it. That is the essence of the working time regulations, and it's the essence of the right to annual leave. But one of the reasons, I was going to say, I mean, obviously one of the reasons it's gone to the Supreme Court is that it is a complex issue. Even 13 years after the working time regulations came into force, there are still atypical workers and, you know, particular sectors where it isn't actually wholly clear how the annual leave provisions work. And it is unfortunate that it takes all this time and all this money to go to the Supreme Court to sort these matters out.
I mean, do you think the oil workers here are being as maybe unrealistic as teachers asking for holidays off during term time?
It's one of these issues where you can see it from both perspectives, and certainly from the employees' perspective. And they're saying, we work an 80 or 90 hour week offshore, which averages out at 40, 45 hours a week if you take it throughout the year. And we really should have holidays on top of that. And why should we be forced to take our holidays in a period when we wouldn't normally be at work anyway? It becomes meaningless then. I'm not really getting holidays because I wouldn't be at work then. So you can see it from the employee's perspective, and you can see the argument that was used, in front of the Supreme Court. It's just given that particular pattern of work that they do work, where there are 26 weeks where, in effect, they're on holiday or they're not at work, the court's view is, that's the period in which the employer can require you to take leave.
You're listening to North Sound Energy Week.
And we'll bring you all the latest on the possibility of industrial action here on the Energy Week podcast. On Thursday, a new report from the Auditor General claimed Scotland's climate change targets for 2020 could come with a £10 billion price tag. The survey showed greenhouse gas emissions have fallen by a quarter since 1990. Government plans to cut this further include green transport policies and home insulation schemes. Green MSP Alison Johnson told me there was no time to waste.
Well, I think it's just outlining that we have to take these commitments seriously and work sensibly, methodically towards the targets. And we simply can't delay, because delay is going to cost us more. I think successive governments haven't taken enough action early enough. And reducing emissions early gives us the best value for money. And a further delay, clearly, according to this report, can't be justified in environmental or economic terms.
So what do you think, from your party's perspective, Alison, are the main priorities here to achieve these targets?
Well, I think we need to look at policies on transport, on housing, on insulation. It's going to cost us. The Stern report has highlighted that if we don't invest in this action, it's going to cost us a lot more. We're seeing more flooding. We're all witnessing, far more frequent sort of serious weather events. But we need to be looking at insulating absolutely every home in Scotland to make sure we don't have people falling into fuel poverty. And the great thing about that policy is environmentally sound, but look at all the employment it provides too. And we could be building a really skilled workforce who understood how to insulate our difficult-to-treat buildings. We have a lot of tenements and so on in Scotland.
And really putting some extra money in people's pockets at the same time.
Absolutely. Far too many people are having to make, a devastating choice whether to feed their families or whether to heat their homes. We have too many damp homes. Our homes, far too often aren't built for the Scottish climate. Sometimes I wonder what we're thinking about if we compare and contrast with homes in Scandinavia where insulation standards and so on are so much higher.
And you mentioned the transport policies, Alison. They've been highlighted here as, one of the main areas that really needs to be pushed through hard to make sure that we reach these targets.
Yeah, well, I think, we're spending a fairly substantial part of the budget. The government has prioritised this on trunk road building. And, my inbox is inundated with people saying, can't we have even a tiny fraction more of this spent on active travel so that cycling in Scotland becomes something that isn't a daunting prospect, so that we have lots of great cycle lanes and really good facilities that mean that youngsters start doing this in primary school and it just becomes a way of life, as it is in different countries on the continent where they've succeeded in making this cultural change.
And I mean, you talk about cultural change there. The 2020 figure has been bandied about for a long time now, but when you actually stop and think about it, it's not that far away. Do you think that's a cultural change that can be brought in time?
It can only be brought in with a great deal of political will. I mean, the amount of funding I've seen diverted away from things like housing and so on and transferred into a roads budget doesn't give me great hope, but it's certainly not a fight that we're going to, we're going to keep saying this is a win-win situation. If we provide, jobs in construction and insulation and so on, look at the amount of youth unemployment we have currently. Let's set up apprenticeships and sort of green jobs. There's a lot we could be doing, and it just, you know, it's the right thing to do on so many levels, environmentally, financially, socially. So we have, you know, eight years to get there. But if we were absolutely determined, I'm sure we could do a great deal getting towards that target. The report has clearly showed us where we are and what we have to do. And, you know, we really welcome the fact that Scotland has such ambitious climate change targets. But it will be a tragedy if they were only to be targets. There's no point in setting an aspiration and not doing all that you can to achieve it. You know, Scotland's got a real opportunity here to lead the way. And, you know, let's take advantage of that and make sure that people know us for being a clean, green, economically and financially sound, as well as incredibly environmentally responsible country.
And that's the Energy Week podcast. I'm Fiona Winchester.
This is the North Sound Energy Week podcast.